272.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Senate Bill 272 relates to public contract award considerations relating to the qualifying persons, and the committee heard the bill many months ago, and there were a number of issues that needed to be worked out, and at this point we believe all interest parties are in reasonable agreement. We have an amendment which I think would be appropriate to be reviewed with you by Dugan Petty, who is with the Department of Administrative Services.
Welcome and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dugan Petty. I am the State Purchasing Manager with DAF CPPS, and I have with me this afternoon Terry Meehan, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. The amendment that you have in front of you seeks to resolve the concerns that were expressed in the last hearing. There were concerns about, I'll just move backwards for a moment. The bill initially tried to break out the criteria for determining disqualification or debarment of a bidder and the criteria for determining the responsibility of the bidder. And those processes are typically separate. So we set out in the bill a one section that simply said for determining responsibility, if it had to do with the bidder's capacity, integrity, reliability to perform the contract fully and in good faith. There was concern that that wasn't specific enough, too broad, too much discretion on the part of the public contracting agency. We had met with AGC, as well as the Association of Building Contractors, and have included in the amendment on the first page criteria in which the public agency would consider when they're determining responsibility. And these are out of the American Bar Association Model Procurement Code rules, so they are fairly well thought through. And in addition to that, we've added with respect to a satisfactory record performance and a satisfactory record of integrity, documentation. So the public contracting agency must have documentation to make that decision. And those resolve concerns of both of those groups. In addition, we had in the original bill the ability for DAS to establish by rule other reasons for which a contractor could be disqualified or debarred. That was, again, some concern about perhaps too much discretion on a public agency, and we've agreed to drop that section. If we have an additional thing that comes up that we think causes enough concern that we would have to follow through with a debarment disqualification, we would be coming back to the legislature and identifying that and asking you to amend the statute to give us that. In addition, in the original bill, it removed the criteria for revocation or revision or revoking pre-qualified bidder. The idea was that that ought to be the discretion of the agency. The AGC had concerns about that, and what you see from page 2, section 3 or section 4 on, is putting back in a reference to the factors that establish responsibility. So I believe the parties that you heard during the original hearing on this bill are satisfied that this takes care of most of their concerns, and I think it's a responsible and fair step forward in how we administer contracts.
And you're just here for advice.
Terry Meehan, Department of just any day you have any questions.
Sean, did you want to say anything or is everything fine? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Meehan, a couple of questions. Yeah. On the amendments on the dash 2, the satisfactory record of performance, and then on line 13, satisfactory record of integrity, those seems rather subjective. Should I assume that there are some court definitions that have resulted from disputes over whether or not somebody had that record of performance or integrity?
Chair Nelson, Senator Miller, With respect to the satisfactory record of performance, that would, to the extent you go beyond a history of performance, you would typically set that out for special requirements in the solicitation document, so that if we had a need for a large software development contract, you would set forth special criteria. A bidder that was concerned about the criteria could then object to that if they thought it unduly restricted competition. That's typically how that would work.
And the integrity?
Chair Nelson, Senator Miller. Well, once again, the integrity would go to normal criteria of integrity with respect to general performance of the contract. You could also set out special criteria in the bid document as well. Should it be, say, for a hazardous waste disposal, you could heighten the levels of bidder integrity, and that could be challenged as well under a bid protest process.
Well, it sounds like you're saying they could require that. I'm saying, how does the bidder demonstrate their record of integrity? And you just said they've performed well in other contracts and in a timely fashion, or what is your notion of integrity as opposed to their nice, honest, decent people?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, I think integrity goes to business ethics and business practices. If they have, for example, a documented history of erroneous billing or billing that's incorrect or some sort of practice that clearly is outside the bounds of ethical business practice that is documented, then that would go to the issue of integrity. It goes beyond the issue of contract performance, and I think that's one that's more documentable, where you have performance expectations that are set out in contract, and where they haven't met those would be documented, and there would have to be evidence of unsatisfactory performance, and this would require that with the documentation.
Now, if someone, let's say, had a dispute at some point in their contract or after performance over the price or whatever the situation might be, and let's say an administrative hearing or a court indeed found against this bidder, what does that do to their record of integrity? Does that have to be a repeated performance? Does it have to be a particularly egregious offense? I'm trying to get a measurement here so people aren't eliminated on someone's notion of integrity that may not be too substantial.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Miller, clearly if a court had a finding that someone's performance on a particular contract had been unsatisfactory, then that could be criteria here. If they had been found of some sort of fraudulent business practice or business practice that would go to the integrity question, then that could play into this. But I believe that this doesn't depend upon having a finding in a court of law to substantiate that. It would require, though, documentation in the file that the performance had been unsatisfactory. And this is not just satisfactory performance, but that there is some record of bad performance going on here. And, of course, they would have the ability to challenge that. That decision is a decision by the procurement officer at the time that the contract is awarded, based upon the procurement officer's decision on this criteria, that the contractor has the ability to perform the job. And it's a protection built in to the contracting process to make sure that the public agency isn't awarding a contract to somebody who clearly couldn't be able to do it for a lot of documented reasons.
If I might ask, Mr. Chairman, if you finish second or somewhere down the line, does the bidder who lost, are they given the reasons why they lost? I mean, if you declare that you were good and everything else, but you just lacked integrity, do they get to hear that from you?
Yep, Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, they would. If an award, the law requires public contracting agency to award a bid to the lowest responsible bidder. And if you are awarding to someone other than the low bidder, that means that they're either not responsible or not responsive. In either case, we have an obligation to determine what the reasons for that are, and the bidder needs to understand what those are, and they would be able to protest those reasons and have appeal and redress on that.
Thank you.
Chair Nelson, Senator Miller. The second bidder in line would not have an opportunity to hear whether it was responsible because you would first go to the lowest bidder. The only reason you could not award the contract to that low bidder is if you found him to be non-responsible. So they would be aware of the fact.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Chairman.
Any comments on the chair would move to the last amendment. Any comments? Objection? Hearing none, so moved. Chair moves Senate Bill 272 as amended to the following the new House recommendation. Any objections? Comments? So ordered. Anybody else to carry this bill? That's going to be Senator Metzger? All right.
It's in the fire, I had an interest in.
Senate Bill 448 is about fee charged by county surveyors for reviewing cemeteries. You may remember that when the committee conducted the hearing, there were a number of representatives from counties indicating a concern about the cost, the real cost associated with conducting the survey or verifying the survey. And so as a result, after further discussion between the interest parties, the bill has been severely amended, and at this point, with the amendment, the bill only has one of the original two sections left. And if you have a copy of the bill, you would find that Section 2 remains. Section 1 is gone. And Section 1 deals with modification or limitation of fees. 2 deals with the egress and access issue. You might remember, again, in current requirement, statutory requirement, a lot, which is the site for the grave, requires an access easement, so there has to be space around it for people in theory to walk in this narrow strip in between grave sites. And the desire or the request of the Cemetery Association is to be able to pull that requirement out of the reality that most people actually walk over other people's gravesite to get to the sites that they're visiting. And what you see in the amendment language for Section 2 is the requirement of disclosure to consumers. So it's in fact that the practice, prospective buyers ought to know that is the practice prior to making a decision. And we do have representatives of the Cemetery Association here if you have further questions. Otherwise, we also have received communications from the representatives of counties who testified initially to express concern that at this point they're okay with the amendment. There are no further objections.
Any questions about this? Deleted all of Section 1.
Section 1 is deleted. The old Section 2 becomes new Section 1. And in Section, the new Section 1 sub 2 at the end that talks about a lot in the cemetery subdivision will include the access easement, etc., says that the authority must disclose the potential to potential purchaser of a lot that the cemetery, of the cemetery, the existence of the access easement across the lot.
Okay.
So people who don't care can just continue to walk over other people's graves, but they at least know beforehand. And one of the benefits that was discussed of the change is to allow cemeteries to economize space because as more as population grow and land requirements increase in cities or urban areas, there just isn't a whole lot of land available for burial sites.
Any questions? Chair, move. Ask for an amendment. Comments? Objections? Any none? So move. Chair, move Senate Bill 448 as amended to the following due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So Chair will carry that. This is my area.
This is your area.
At a very young age, this is my political life.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. We open up our work session on Senate Bill 1055, Hightower Prohibition.
Members, if you have a copy of the staff notes and summary, the staff notes and summary already included the highlights of the amendment. Committee had gathered a hearing on the 23rd, which I think was last Friday, and there is the need to clarify and actually further restrict the allowance that this bill would provide in having common directorship of parent companies of manufacturer of alcoholic liquor and retail licensees of alcoholic liquor. And so the amendment basically does two things. One, it clarifies that a retail licensee must make, because it applies to Oregon licensees, that they must make all purchases of alcoholic beverages from holders of wholesale, winery, or brewery licenses in Oregon. That's one clarification. And the second clarification is it actually further narrows the concurrent service on boards of directors. Initially it's to corporations as well as the parent companies of these corporations, and now we're limiting the allowance only to the parent companies.
Any questions? Chair has moved back on amendment. It's going to be 1055. Comments? Objections? Ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 1055 to forward the due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So ordered. Senator Bill, would you like
to? You bet. Okay.
Open up a work session on Senate Bill 1086.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1086 relates to disclosing information about wage and employment to consumer reporting agencies. The committee conducted a hearing on this bill on Friday last week, and at that time we indicated that there is need for further amendments. And the amendment does two things. One, it clarifies the credit reporting agency will bear all costs associated with revising incomplete or inaccurate wage records performed for the credit transaction. So it's to clarify that the employment department would be able to recover the costs associated with this additional activity. And then the second point of the amendment is to clarify that the employment department does not bear any liability associated with the improper release of information by the consumer reporting agency. Once the information is shared with the agency, then they no longer have the responsibility beyond that. We do have representatives of the employment department as well as the organization that proposed the bill. If you have any questions, I'm sure they'd be happy to answer. I believe you have a copy of the statement from legislative fiscal office on this bill, and it has a whole bunch of blanks in there. Which points you have to go, we'll fill in later.
Fill in later.
But yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right
in there,
yeah.
Well, the reason why it's blank is because at this point it's difficult to project the actual expenditure. However, the bill ensured that all related expenditures will be paid for by the employment reporting or the credit reporting agency. So it's going to be a wash, and potentially the state will get a little more money the first month. In addition, on the effect on positions, right now it's blank. So we have lots of blanks for expenditure and revenue, and then we have nothing under the effect on positions. There is a projected increase in positions. Two positions is projected in a total of 2.33 FTE. And that will have to go through later on the EBO process to be rectified if the bill goes through the next December.
I'm developing a potential for problems here with all of our... The last sentence of the employment department maintains only 15 quarters, and cost would be significantly increased if 15 quarters are needed.
Mr. Chair, in our amendment, we had modified, we had changed the 16 to 15,
right,
just to make sure that the cost is reasonable.
That's not a problem. You want to make some comments, please come up and...
Mr. Chair, finally, I appreciate the indulgence. Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. We did, Ms. Chang did a very good job of explaining the kind of quandary that we're in terms of the not knowing exactly what the cost will be, but one of the things that our budget people wanted to be clear on the record was that we will need bodies to actually perform the work that will be required by the bill. And so even though the money and the revenue stream may be covering those positions, we do need at some point position authority from the emergency board. We don't believe that that needs to slow up the bill at this point in time. We just wanted to get that on the record. And in other states, this has been a revenue generator because you look at the shared cost of maintaining the system. And so we actually get some more dollars than the actual current cost of that. So we would potentially need an expenditure limit authorization too for other funds. All those things can be taken care of down the line, but we just wanted to make sure the committee was aware of them. So.
How many people do you think you might have to hire?
Mr. Chair, the two FTE that's reflected would be reflected for some office specialists who would have the two for cleaning up wage records. Then we would likely need someone to help assist with the contract development, but that would only be for the initial period of time. And then some IS people for the discussions with the various consumer reporting agencies about our system and how they can interact together. Those, again, would only be for limited periods of time. So that's why the FTE and the positions are a little bit different, as Ms. Chen reported. So overall, it's the two positions and the 2.33 FTE, since we'll have some of them for only a part of the biennium. We are required, just so you know, for the record as well, that any funds that are generated as part of this have to go back to the UI program. So we do have to reinvest them at the Department of Labor requirement. So we thought about maybe we could use them for childcare or something else, but they say that that's not appropriate. So we will have to reinvest them in the UI program.
Okay. Just to refresh my memory, maybe remember the committee's purpose of the bill again was...
Mr. Chair, the purpose of the bill was to allow consumer reporting agencies to access electronically wage records that are reported by employers on their employees, so they can get those electronically instead of having to go to the employer themselves and say, can you give us a record of the wages? And it does require the individual to consent to that release of their wages.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Very good. Chair will move the Gaslin Amendment to Senate Bill 1086. Any comments? Objections? None. The order is the Chair will move Senate Bill 1086 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So. Okay. They're just moving right along.
I know, yeah.
Okay, so open up the work session on 1081.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Senate Bill 1081 deals with electrical specialty codes. And there are two components, two aspects to this bill. The first aspect, which is outlined in Section 1, requires municipalities that have a electrical specialty code program to hire or to provide field inspections. And right now that is not a service that's broadly uniformly available. This would mandate that service be available. And the second aspect is of the bill is related to equipment which requires special certification. And in fact, that was heard originally by the committee as Senate Bill 480. And I believe you might remember the story of a printing press, which was imported and had components that are not under Rider Laboratory certified, and therefore require a fairly extensive process to have the material certified, the equipment certified. And in the meantime, it was red tagged, which means that it was not available. It could not be used or operated. And then there was another example of a bakery that imported a piece of equipment from some European country. And again, it was not certified according to our standards, and that therefore rendered equipment not usable. The bill is intended to provide two solutions for those situations. One, clarify that the municipalities need to provide inspection service so there are more avenues available to people who need that kind of service. Right now, they either go to the state or they have to go to an outside laboratory, testing laboratory, which costs a lot of money. I think in the case of the press, it was $8,000 to $10,000. The Catholic press, $8,000. We heard examples of $5,000 up to $10,000 of the laboratory testing fees. And the purpose for having broader options really is to reduce the cost as well as giving the consumers a range of options depending on their time needs and financial capabilities. The second aspect really is to clarify, in terms of inspection of these electrical equipment, industrial electrical equipment, what is the scope of inspection? Right now, the statute is fairly silent on that. And so a testing laboratory or a special deputy doing an inspection basically looks at everything. And that includes the amount of time required and cost associated with the inspection of the certification. What this bill does now with the amendment is to clarify the scope. So we provide a focus, we provide an additional avenue, and that we think is a sensible solution, but still provides for the caveats and safeguards they need to be for safety of operating these industrial electrical equipment. Because this amendment is a little bit more complicated, there has been a lot of new language added to it. I think it may be prudent for us to ask Gary Wilson, who is the state's chief electrical inspector, to come up and walk you through this amendment. And Grover Simmons, who has had a very strong interest in this bill, could come up and perhaps offer his perspective as well.
And then we do have the representatives from county, and the municipalities have had some concerns in this bill as well in terms of the impact on them. And CJ, would you be a CJ Smith with Clackamas County? Might be a good person to give you some feedback.
Sure. Very proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Wilson, Chief Electrical Inspector for the state. As you know, we've kicked this bill around two or three times previously, trying to come up with something that is acceptable to all concerned parties. When the first bill, the language of the first bill required that the local cities and municipalities employ a special deputy program. There was some concern about that at our last hearing. So the language had been changed that the city and counties that administer the electrical specialty code shall have their field inspectors that are presently on staff perform this function of doing the inspection. So that clarified that. And then for those municipalities who have contracting type inspections, the bill also accounts for that and accommodates that, as well as for those cities and counties that have no inspection program, the bill addresses those three entities. So that should cover the concerns of having to employ a special deputy inspector should not be necessary. Section 479(540) has always exempted industrial equipment from overall listing as being a certified product. Problem comes when a piece of equipment comes in that is not in the scope of any type of standards. We have to examine those pieces of equipment and ensure that they meet minimum safety. In order to do that, we've come up with some guidelines that help distinguish what has to be looked at and what does not really require to be of great importance for fire and shock hazards. I'd like to point out on the legislation on page 6, line 7 of the new language which defines industrial electrical equipment, says that is factory wired using separately certified components and is custom made, limited produce, or outside the scope as determined by the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services for the standards and requirements of Underwriters Laboratories, Canadian Standards Association, or American National Standards Institute as an effect on the effective date of this 1999 Act. What I want to explain to you is that these entities, associations, and corporations are the ones that establish standards to what products can be evaluated to, and they have testing procedures for certain products. One of the concerns that we have is that we were looking at those pieces of equipment that had uncertified components, and with the new legislative language that's put in here, I would recommend that on line 7, right after the word separately certified components, insert or uncertified components, so we can address those pieces of equipment that come in that do not have components on there that are certified by a recognized testing agency. And when we get into those entities that are considered by the director, back on page 1, this is where we apply these positive indicators of product safety on page 1, lines 14 through. And that would meet the intent of meeting minimum safety and excluding a lot of time on inspecting some of these pieces of equipment where 80% of it's all control circuitry and under voltages where it would not create a fire and shock hazard. If there's any questions, I'm sure be glad to answer those.
Mr. Chair, could I just comment on what Mr. Wilson just suggested? We did provide language, as Mr. Wilson had provided, to Ledge Council, and what was intended to be inserted in page six, line six on, to define further industrial electrical equipment and put under that two categories. The first category would be what's called factory wired using separately certified components, which means that in the factory you take a whole bunch of pieces that are separately certified by some laboratory that's recognized, that you put them together and make a new thing out of these certified components. So that methane now has to be checked.
Right.
So that's the first category. The second category would be something that is just not certified at all, or the components are not certified at all. My understanding is council had intended the first phrase on line 8 that says outside of scope to include the uncertified pieces coming together into a separately assembled, custom-made, one-of-a-type equipment here. So there may not be the need for that amendment language. Perhaps it's not as clear to us lay people, but as I understand legally, everything is covered at this point. I just want to offer that.
Mr. Chair, to Ms. Shane, yes, and that was one of the concerns that Mr. Simmons had, was the fact that the original a document we submitted that did cover uncertified components and certified components, that language was not in this. And I think he and Mr. Grover would like to have it on record that outside the scope would indeed include those components that are uncertified. And I concur with that.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Grover Simmons, representing Independent Employer Association and primarily the training community. Well, thank you for working on this bill with us. We are in agreement with the Chief State Electrical Inspector. We've negotiated this bill almost word by word, and with the intent on the record as to what he means and what the staff has explained regarding uncertified equipment, that's okay with us. After all, he's going to be administering this thing statewide, and what he says is going to be the way it's done at the local level, and that's okay with us. So if everybody understands that uncertified equipment is acceptable under certain circumstances, we're all right. There was a concern last time about listed components on fuses and fuse holders, and so I called New Jersey, one of the major manufacturers of equipment, Kolbus, which is a German manufacturer. I said, how does this requirement of certified fuses and fuse holders stack up? And so Mr. Wilson explained to me that there are manufacturers of fuses throughout the world, particularly in Europe and Japan, where they can get the right fuses with UL labels and use them in their products. So they will come to us with those fuses meeting the standard that we're talking about. So I signed on to that concept as well, as so did those other two suppliers, the Japanese manufacturers and certainly one of those European Kolbus who manufactures in Germany. So we got those people together. So on balance, we are happy, we think. And just to again relate what the staff indicated, the cost of this is what triggered this bill. Graphic Arts Center in Portland paid $15,000 for outside third-party testing lab. The bakery was $6,000. Foreman Douglas Corporation Beaverton was $2,500. The Oregon Catholic Press, they paid $4,000, and they expect another invoice for $4,000. That's where your $8,000 comes. So forth. So we think that this will, it does address the problem, and we think it will settle it down and we can live with it. And so thank you. Hope you pass the bill.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm B.J. Smith. I am Public Relations and Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. You'll recall a couple of weeks ago our Chief Inspector, Eugene Morgan, appeared before the committee, raised some concerns about this bill. He has been subsequently involved in the discussions about the bill, and I just sent him a copy of this. He reviewed it, and he felt that this was an acceptable compromise among the parties. So I just wanted to report back to you, and thank you very much for the opportunity to, I guess, take care of our concerns that were raised.
Do you have any problems with the mandate prior to these encounters to do this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee I usually have problems with mandates.
Yes.
I have a reaction. But, you know, of course, we opt into this program and we assume the responsibility under state law. And so from that standpoint, we are willing partners in the implementation of the Uniform State Building Code.
Okay.
In closing, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one last comment. As a result of our discussion on this bill at our last meeting, we did have a meeting of Portland, Clackamas County, Gresham. All the major concerns in the northern part of the state where a lot of this equipment is coming into. And it was this group that put together the language for this. So thank you for supporting the bill.
So I was just going to mention to BJ, I think when we passed 587 out, we have a provision that all counties will do all parts of the code. And so I think this is already required now in there. So the mandate's on its way.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that the county has a very strong electrical inspection and time review program, and fine.
Mr. Chair, before you move to an amendment and take action on the bill, I think it's important as we're talking about mandates to local governments for members to note the -2 amendment, the lower on page 1, the lower half of that entire page is basically clarifying components of what used to be required inspection or certification that no longer need to be done. This is from step 4, that the director shall consider the following as positive indicators of a product safety. And then it goes on a long list of items. So what this bill is doing is, in fact, narrowing the scope of the inspection required. And that came out of the consensus discussion. So even though it may look like it's making more work, we're making some jurisdictions do more work. In fact, when they conduct the work, it may be far less.
Very good. Chair, you indicate that we don't think we need to be concerned about the discussion over adding uncertain or uncertified components.
My understanding is that the language takes care of it legally, and if there is any questions, there certainly is time for that to be addressed in the House.
Okay, so the moving -2 amendment under consideration. The Chair would move the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 1081. Any comments? Objections?
So ordered.
Chair of Meeting, Senate Bill 10081, as amended to the referral of the due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So ordered. Who would like to carry? Senator Beyer? Who would like to carry? Senator Beyer? Senator Beyer?
He's our building code guy.
All right, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1310. And Mr. Taylor and Jenna and Robert Nelson, the office come forth. Welcome. Long and winding road, hasn't it?
Mr. Chairman, General Ingram with the Oregon Association of Realtors. I hardly know what to say. Senate Bill 1310 is the Oregon Association of Realtors portion of what was contained in 182. We tagged this bill, this provision, onto a bill thinking it would be non-controversial. We were also wrong. Senator Beyer was very gracious and offered to introduce this bill as, or this portion of a separate bill on our behalf, which we have done. There is an amendment, the -1 amendment, and if I can really, very quickly, this is going to be a very brief testimony because you've already gone over earlier. However, all the -1 amendments do is include in the definition of commercial property land that is available for commercial development, and such as bare land. We didn't want to just include those properties that had commercial structures on them. We have the commissioner here today in support of the bill, and we also have a practitioner in case you, Bob Nelson, in case you need to go over once more why this bill is necessary, but we would just encourage its passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I think we had a thorough discussion. Any comments? Joe, do you have any comments on any of this?
I don't, Mr. Chair. The amendment really is to take care of drafting errors. And if the committee adopts the bill, when the bill is cleaned up, eventually the catch line will need to be corrected as well. Obviously, that's not within the scope of our amendment. And if you look at the catch line, it's not now it reads, authorizes licensed real estate brokers to share residential real estate commission. It really should be non-residential real estate commission. That's the scope of the issue here.
Okay, very good. Any comments? Any questions? Close the public hearing. We'll have a work session on Senate Bill 1310. The chair moves the dash one amendment. Any comments? Any further discussions or questions in the panel? We just moved the dash one amendment.
Mm-hmm.
No objection. So ordered. And the chair moves Senate Bill 1310 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Good bill should pass.
Okay, and no objections. Ordered, and now we think it's close. Senator Byer wants to carry this one too.
She's nodding, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your patience in this process. All right, where are we? We're going to have a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 4.
Mr. Chair, by mutual consent of the chair of this committee and the Rules Committee, CR 4 is requested to be transferred to the Rules Committee or referred to the Rules Committee out of the committee with no recommendation.
All right, any comments?
Excellent idea.
And this is the rules.
Right over there.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I'm on that committee.
There's the vice chair right there. Okay.
There you go, for.
We'll send it back.
Okay, we're going to have a motion. The chair moves that we move Senate Concurrent Resolution 4 to the Rules Committee without any recommendation. Comments? Objections? So ordered. And should the business come before the committee?
What?
Do you want to stay longer?
What?
What?
Sure, we have a